This week on Out in the Air features Real Sound Recording Studio founder Paul Waters, who operates Northwest Indiana's only analog 24-track recording studio. Next, we have pastel artist Umala June, who focuses on the balance and interplay between human form and surrealistic landscapes. Our spotlight's on Michigan City's Messiah's 61st year, presented December 13th and 14th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight Phil Bauman, who's the conductor of the 61st season of Handel's Messiah in Michigan City, and they'll be at St. Mary the Immaculate Conception Church, and we'll talk more about that. There'll be two performances, December 13th and Sunday, December 14th. Phil, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight to tell us all about it.
Hi, Larry and Esther. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to talk to you about our concerts coming up.
Yeah, it's good to see you again.
Same here.
So tell us about your history with it. This has been like the 61st season. I'm sure you haven't been there all 61st seasons, but tell us your involvement.
I started when I was four. No, 10 years ago. So I'm celebrating a 10-year anniversary, but 10 years ago, Dan McNabb finished his 50th season and decided maybe it was time to move on to something else. And so he reached out to me. We had some great conversations. And I think because of a relationship I had with a mutual member in the group, Marjorie Larson, who worked with me at the LaPorte Symphony, she got the two of us together years before he decided to retire. So when he did decide to retire, he said, "Phil, would you like to take this over?" And I said, "Absolutely. What an honor." And so it was a very gracious handoff. And I think part of the reason was he knew I could handle that delicate transition between somebody being someone in a place for that many years and then suddenly a new person. And, you know, how do they deal with that? And how do they caress the group into being on your team now and respecting what had happened in the past? So it's gone by very quickly those past 10 years.
So tell us about you. I'd obviously, the Messiah is a long piece, so I don't think you do the complete piece. Tell us about how you do that. And also, you have a mix of course, some professionals and, of course, local people that want to perform and be part of it. So tell us about that process.
Yes. We do almost the entire work. We leave off about maybe 8 or 10 pieces. So we do most of everything in the first and the third sections. The second section, we do trim a little bit. So it's a 2 hour plus, maybe 2 hours and 15 minute production of all those pieces strung together with no applause, which is kind of it's a bit of a journey for the audience, because you do the Hallelujah chorus and they go, "Okay, really? I have to just sit down now or just sit there?" But it's a wonderful journey. By the time we get to the final amen, we are just in an ecstatic state and the audience erupts very, very enthusiastically. And so, yes, we do have a mix of choir members who come from all walks of life, church choirs, high school choirs, college choirs, people who've been in singing their entire life, but it is a volunteer course. So anyone who is interested in singing with us can do that. We give them some materials in terms of how we're interpreting the pieces, some musical notes. We can give them a score if they need it. But that's, it's open to the public. So it's not just the Michigan City community as far as the choir members are concerned. And we have a professional orchestra from Chicagoland area and Northwest Indiana, and four amazing professional soloists. So the choir is, people think an amateur choir, this is not what you're going to hear. You're going to hear a very refined and polished group of singers who've been, many of them been doing this for, 10, 20 years.
So there's technically no auditions then, right? Or
that's correct. And so, people will come for, we kind of promote the notion that you can join us, but obviously in the fall when we start our rehearsals is kind of the big push for the recruit. But yes, people come in. I think it's somewhat self-regulating. I think when people come and hear the choir, see what level they're at and assess where they're at, they can say, yep, I can do this. Or they say,
not this year.
Maybe I'll be in the audience this year. But
is St. Mary's the new home of it?
It is. Oh yeah. And being someone from Michigan City, what a fabulous place that is. And so 2 years ago, we came back to the church. We were at Holdcraft Performing Arts Center for a couple of years during, as we came out of COVID, we needed a space where our audience could be a little more spread out. So we went to that space. But after a couple of years there, we realized that necessity was a little less stringent upon us. So we came and got a very warm welcome from St. Mary's to be in their place. So, the acoustics in that facility are fantastic. And last year was our first year giving a performance there. And just the proximity of all of us, with the orchestra being right there and the choir members just maybe 6 or 7 feet away from us in that space on the altar area, was just an incredible experience for us as performers. And then the audience, we were just blown away by how beautiful it sounded in that space. So we're glad to bring it back to the church.
I'll give you a quick opportunity to talk about any other projects you've got going on beyond Messiah.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm living kind of in the vocal world these days. I'm the music director for the South Holland Master Chorale in South Holland, Illinois. We do three performances every year, series of performances, two of each. And then on the non-musical side of life, I'm the production manager for the South Bend Symphony. So I reside now in South Bend. So it's a real nice balance for me as a person, because on one hand, I can be the person who facilitates the conductor and make sure he has everything he needs to do a fantastic performance. And the conductor and I are on really good terms, and we talk conductor talk backstage sometimes. But he can cry on my shoulder or say things to me that you probably can't say to too many other people. And I go, yeah, I know what you mean. And so it's a very good relationship, but still firmly planted in the musical world, which I love, of course.
That's great.
So Philip, would you share the dates of the Messiah with everyone?
Just to remind your listeners, we're doing these performances on Saturday evening, December 13th, and Sunday afternoon, December 14th. So popularity demands that we do two performances. So we have one for the evening crowd and one for the afternoon crowd.
Well, that sounds great. That's Philip Baumann. He's the conductor of the 61st season of Handel's Messiah in Michigan City. They'll be at St. Mary's Immaculate Conception Church. You can find out information. It's on Saturday, December 13th at 7 p.m. And then a matinee, I guess you'd call it, in the theater world, Sunday, December 14th. And you can find out information about that. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight and sharing all about the Messiah performance.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hi everyone, this is recording artist David Arkenstone, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Paul Waters to Art on the Air. Paul has been interested and involved in the music business for numerous years, as a sound engineer. He flirted with an internet radio station, and then he started AP Radio and Recording. A few transformations take place working with vintage gear from the 80s with the goal of recapturing a lost art and sound. Analog breathes where digital does not. In November of 2025, they changed the studio name to Real Sound Recording. Everything done the vintage way, recording on tape. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Paul. It's very, very nice meeting you.
Thank you. Nice meeting you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Paul, like we always start with all of our guests, we want to get their background story or their origin story. So tell us how you got from where you were, like where you grew up and everything, to where you are now.
Okay, well, I'm born and raised in Highland, graduated in 1982. Started going to the clubs in 84 when I was 20, because I didn't turn 21 until the end of the year. Went to Club Dimensions, for the people that are in the region are very familiar with that. My first band was Monterey, and I was going to film school at that time. And for reasons that are too long to explain, I didn't follow that. I gravitated into music, and I was bopping around following Monterey, and they played at Jelly Ginger's. And their Mike Anton is his name. He was their sound and light guy. And I had known him for a few months. He flaked on them. I don't know what happened. And they came up to me and they said, "Do you know how to run this?" And I look at it and go, "Sure." And I didn't have a clue. I knew one thing and one thing only that Mike showed me, the volume. And that's all I did. And that's how I started in life, in sound. And went to Full Sail in 1986 as the first accredited class. And Full Sail is like the premier university for recording arts now. Interned at TRC, don't like jingles. And that's what was cut mostly in the Midwest. So I moved to LA on a whim. Worked there from 86 to 93. Thought I had my career set, but the music business is very different than the business of music. And people don't understand that until you get in it. The business of music is quite disgusting. So I walked away for 35 years. I was talking with a recently passed friend of mine, Tony Ortega, in 2018 about going to radio. And I bought some equipment, 2017. For whatever reasons, we never could get it off the ground. In 2018, I opened AP Radio. And again, on a whim, I was on eBay or something. And I typed in Tascam MSR-16, which is a half-inch 16-track deck that I used to use at the Annex on Hollywood Boulevard back in the 80s. And I found one. And that started this role.
I think it's wonderful. But can we go back to like middle school, high yep. school kind of stuff? What were you interested in then? Is your family musical? No.
I'm the most creative person in my family. My childhood was challenging. It wasn't normal. When I turned 16, my knees started swelling and they started to hurt. By the time I was 18, I walked down the aisle to graduate on a cane. When I was 19, I was told I had ankylosing spondylitis.
Oh.
And so I wanted to play. I dabbled in guitar. I taught myself how to play drums. I took some lessons. But when I got in front of a music desk or a lighting board, it just sort of clicked for me. I'm not a person that will sit and just play my drums or play my guitar, and that's all I hear. I hear the whole thing. And I just can produce really well. I just have an ear for it. And it was more satisfying and interesting than working on an instrument. So I'm a really bad drummer, but I'm a really pretty decent producer.
I just realized when you gave the dates at Highland, I was at Highland as the auditorium and theater director when you were there. So, because I started in 79 and was there till 92. So I was
we ran into each other.
Well, probably. You know, I was the crazy theater guy there. So,
yeah, I'm so excited you're doing this. It's wonderful. Larry and I were talking earlier and I said it's almost the equivalent of like the resurgence of the pinball arcade. You know, it's just.
Well,
really cool.
The last year would have been 2019. Sweetwater had this thing called Gear Fest. It's So like a 3-day event, 2-day event in Fort Wayne, Indiana at Sweetwater Sound. There I met Chris Lord-Alge and Joe Satriani and a bunch of others. But I took this class with my son. Now, my son, he was my partner in the station in the beginning, but he's drifted away. His passion isn't in creating music. But we took a class on Pro Tools. And because I firmly anticipated doing both, doing the analog and going to digital. But I'm at this class, and there's a drummer in the drum room, and there's a guy with a big old display with Pro Tools, and they record some drums. And they record 8 bars or whatever. Then he goes back and he's showing you all the things you could do with Pro Tools. And he did something that, I mean, I couldn't believe he did it. You hit a tom, and then in an analog, the tom has the initial attack and then a resonance. He took that resonance out right after the attack. And he said, you can even do this. And he did it. And I go, why on earth would you do that? And everybody looked at me. He goes, well, it's fun. I go, no, don't you understand that tom has a natural resonance that lasts longer than the initial attack? All the old guys knew what I was talking about. The younger guys had no clue because they are not taught how the White Album was made, how any of the Beatles records are made, how was any Aerosmith made, or Led Zeppelin, or Houses of the Holy. They aren't taught that way. They're taught, put it in a box, use auto-tune, use a harmonizer, and only worry about getting 8 bars done, and then I'll just copy and paste. That's not music to me. It is not.
Well, I mean, and we've talked a little bit, I ran a small 4-track, mostly a demo studio, though some of the stuff to get released. And that's how I got to be a voting member for the Grammys. It was kind of odd, but that's another story. But anyway, you're right. And, you know, this resurgence of vinyl, I said, well, it's not just the vinyl. It's the way things were recorded in the 70s and 80s. And for example, jazz especially, they loved using the pan control. So all of a sudden the baritone sax is full left and this, and you get the full stereo spectrum sound, which nowadays, it's recorded in stereo, but it's like a mush of stereo and everything. Yeah.
But what does that mean? You know, it's recorded in stereo.
Right.
I can't take a pot and go left or right.
Right.
I challenge everybody under the age of 50 that is in the box. I go, it's like universally accepted the White Album is probably the best album ever recorded. And it started on 8-track and moved to 16.
Right.
Back when that was made. I challenge anyone to give me a contemporary song, artist, band in the digital era that is iconic in what they've done. You can't, because the way we make music is now truncated, and it's all about pop. And heck, half the live things aren't live anymore.
And they're so processed. I mean, they're over-processed.
Yes. Streaming is one of the worst things ever. It's so over-compressed, I can't hear it. And my hearing's fine, but it's so over-compressed, it just doesn't breathe. And analog breathes. What we used to hate in the 80s, the noise, I love now. I absolutely love it now. Because there's better, because there's ways to manage it, because we did it back then.
Sure.
So wish I knew the answer to this, and I don't, and I apologize for my not knowing, but when you're doing this analog taping, can you just do the vocals? Like, can somebody just sing without any other accompaniment? And what does reel-to-reel bring to that experience?
Well, the recording process in an analog format is you get your bass, your bass drums, your drums, your bass guitar and your rhythm guitar, and then you have what's called a scratch vocal. The vocalist is on a DI box with a SM58 inside the studio just to give them timing. And we lock down the bass and the drums. Don't even care if the rhythm guitar is any good, because I'll overdub it. Then we just build the song. Bass and drums, rhythm section. Then rhythm guitar if it needs to be done again. Then leads. Then vocals, then backgrounds, and then you put the whole song together. And as you do that, you're making multiple passes, and you're tuning, you're dialing in on an analog desk, your mix, your sound. So by the time you get to mix it, it's 90% done. It's just adding effects and doing the tweaking. Right. And it's the creation, as opposed to sitting in front of a computer for 8 hours like you're playing a video game. I don't feel that's creating.
Well, in multi-track recording, you know, even bouncing things like that was even the simplest form, you know, allows you to be creative and layer things. And of course, yeah, like you said, you have to worry about noise, because the best case circumstance for most tape is about 65 dB signal to noise ratio. But, you know, that doesn't matter. It's kind of like the comparison with vinyl record. You have that kind of the noise of the stylus going over the thing, kind of that's part of the warmth or process of that. So,
correct. Yeah. That's for me, that's what makes it. I will never buy a newly pressed vinyl because it's from a digital source.
Right.
I go to the record fairs. I go to those that they have on the weekends all over the place. And I buy used, dated, because that's when it was recorded and pressed off of a half inch master, all analog. And so you get I'm not saying analog is better than digital. Obviously it's not. It's just more human, more of a representation of the sine wave that's analog.
Well, the comparison to photography is, and this is something you'll appreciate, is that one thing that film photography has that digital doesn't is if you blow out the high end in digital, you know, like the go all white, that's not recoverable. On film, to a certain degree, you can pull that back through development. You can pull back the highlights and everything. Right. And of course, and Esther touched on this too, is it's a much more direct process. Microphone straight to the recording device, and then finally, whatever your final output thing is. So you have less steps in between with analog recording. It's otherwise, you know, like you were talking about, you could put it through, you put through vocalizer, through harmonizer, what do you have at the other end of that, of the vocal?
I saw a post on social media. It was in a recording post, a channel I'm in. And the question was, how many tracks have you used to record drums? And there was a guy there that said 95. I replied, oh my God, how could you? Why would you? What's the point? You need seven tracks.
Right.
You need seven, eight, if you want a universal room mic. And if you want to get crazy and put some PZMs in the back, you could have 10 if you want to go nuts, but you need seven. Any more than that, you're just playing, in my opinion. It's ridiculous. Some of the things I see people do in digital, I just shake my head. It's like, it's why music isn't breathing right now. And it's really disappointing.
Paul, I looked on the website and it said a minimum of 4 hours. So what can you accomplish in 4 hours if somebody comes in not as like a novice, maybe?
And well, the way things were done, analog recording is multi-day sessions. You can't get it all done in a day, unless you want to record live to tape, which you can. If you want to do a live, you can. But in a 4-hour session, the goal is basics for however many songs you want to do. That means your bass drum and your bass guitar and your drums and your rhythm section for a 3-song demo. You get that done, and we can get that done in 4 hours. If everybody knows their song, if everybody's really tight, because that's something else with digital. I mean, you can play, like I said, you can play the verse. They'll just copy and paste it to the second verse. Well, for me, you got to play the song. It keeps the artists more honest. It makes them better at their craft because they have to play the whole thing. And the time is relative. If somebody booked 4 hours and it took 6 to get what I wanted done, I'm not going to grouse about it. I'm not. It's about making music this way to expose a generation that is interested, but maybe never had the means. Just like I don't charge anybody for the tape. I'm just as expensive as a digital studio. Now, if they want to own the tape, they got to replace it at my cost.
Right.
Which is about $320 a reel.
And that was my question. Where can you get tape nowadays? I know a few years ago, I kind of looked at it and said, just to see, is tape available? And I first came across refurbished tape, you know, where they take old tapes, erase them, supposedly refurbish them. But where's your source on tape? Is there
There are two. The owners of the original Ampex 456 formula is based out of Pennsylvania, and they are called ATR. The owners of the BASF formula, and those were basically the two tapes back in the day, is out of Paris, and they're called Return the Masters.
Right.
And I buy my tape out of a place called Nashville Recording Supply.
Oh, okay.
Theater tape. They have the they have the tape to, when you're cutting. They have the little white grease pencil. I don't know how I found them, but I found them, and I love them. All the stuff that they that I can get. There is a underground market for analog. Analog never fully went away. It just went away commercially. And in the last 10 years, you've been seeing commercial artists coming back to analog. Lady Gaga wanted to do an album on it, and I can't remember. There's a few others. There's a metal band. I don't want to say Korn, but maybe that's going to be making their next album on tape. And there's actually in Nashville, there is a company called Mara Machines that are rebranding old MCI tape decks. Completely rebuilding them, completely all new, and they're calling them Mara Machines, and they are just MCI tape decks. And they're quite popular.
Question about the Masters. Paul, what is the benefit other than the finance, like to have to, you know, replace the cost of the tape with you? Is there some other reason why it would be good for you to have the master rather than the artist?
No, there's no. You go back a few years ago, when Warner Brothers had a fire, they lost hundreds of classic irreplaceable tapes. I mean, I'll keep it for so long. I'm of the firm believer, the school I was taught in, a rule of thumb in recording in the 80s, you only use a tape for three passes. That means I use the whole tape, which is only 33 minutes long, and then I use it again. And on that third one, that's the last time I use it. So I will keep it for them. It will stay in a climate-controlled studio until I deem I don't want it. And I might never deem I don't want it. I'm not going to have hundreds of master tapes. This is a very select niche market. And that's why the name needed to be changed, because I'm getting too many rappers that want to book an hour and need to come up with a beat. And that's not what I'm about. It's about multi-day recording. It's about sessions. It's about overdubs. And it's about mix. And so it's going to be very selective.
How many clients do you have? I kind of saw the transition from the AP radio and recording studio to, and then that's what being having my little thing back in the 80s, early 80s, 70s, 80s. But, you know, what kind of clients are on your door?
Absolutely none. I have a project band I've worked with for 7 years. People can't get past the cost. That's why I got to the point where I'm willing to get the tape away. If I'm $45 or $50 an hour and someone else is the same and they're in the box and I'm not, so, okay, I take away the cost of the tape. So now, you know, you get the same experience, but you get the same level and pricing, because the biggest thing you're competing with is the bedroom. Who's going to come and give me $400 for a day of recording when they can sit in their bedroom and it doesn't cost them anything? That's another downside of digital. I'm talking to a lot of blues artists because they're the ones that are very receptive to it. Jack Whittle might be coming in. Mandolin and the Hunters, I hope. Mm-hmm. I've been talking to her. My project band is called Coal City. They're an alternative band. I've known them for a long time. I was closed for the summer because my desk shorted out, gave me an excuse to rebuild my 24 track and buy a bigger desk. Sure. and do some remodeling in the studio. So the people I was talking to, I had a half a dozen. They all drifted away because I shut my studio for the summer.
So how do you deliver your final product? I mean, you know, obviously you got 24 track, you'd mix it down to like probably a 2-track version. To your client, what do they get? What's the final thing?
They get a high definition MP3, a regular MP3, and a WAV file. And then I will also give them, because I do have an Alesis HD24 track ADAT that precursored the Pro Tools. Was digital without the software. So I'll give them the stems. They can have that. That's part of the deal. But they will get a MP3 or and a Wave, because you need a Wave to put it on Spotify and all that.
Right. Wave is the, unless it's just radio, Spotify will let radio go on MP3. But yeah, you're right. And a Wave file really contains, is probably one of the best digital formats, because it really contains all the data.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, I have one A to D process, analog to digital, and that is at the final, which is where I believe it always should be. And I said this back in 1989 when they put the Macintosh 2 in the studio, in the A room, at the record plant. I go, that thing's going to ruin music. And I like computers, but that thing's going to ruin music. And that was when they were also going to the direct to disc, where the high end was so shrill it ripped your ears off. The only part of A to D conversion of analog should be at the final process.
Right. Well, I think direct to disc works basically for symphonies and maybe jazz.
I agree.
In a live performance type setting, I think that's the only way that worked.
I agree. Yeah, and I have the ability to go out of my analog boards straight into the ADAT. Because, you know, I color the sound with the board because it's an analog piece of gear. So I am getting some warmth and breath from the board, so it doesn't have to go to the tape machine.
Well, you know, we have a minute left here. We want to give you a chance to let people know about your studio, how they can get in touch with you, how they can find out about you, and maybe some people will want to try the analog way as opposed to the digital way.
I would love to hear from them. You can find me at realsoundrecording.com. We also have a Facebook page, same name, an Instagram, same name. You can email me at info@realsoundrecording.com, and I will get back to you. You can call or text if you want, 219-741-4883. I would love to talk to anybody that's interested. And it's about making music for me, not making money. That's what turned me away from music 35 years ago, 40 years ago. It was only about making money. It wasn't about making the music. And I want to make the music. I don't care about the money. If I make it, I make it. If I don't, I don't.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air, sharing your new journey with realsoundrecording.com. You can get a hold of Paul Waters right there. And if you're interested in taking a different path to creating music, him working with you, you can do so. Paul, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your journey.
Thanks for having me. This has been a ball. Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, it's been so incredibly fascinating. Thank you.
Anytime. Love to do it again.
And after a brief pause, we'll return to our guest today on Art on the Air. Our show relies on the support of not only our show underwriters, but also our listeners who make donations to this station. Your support of this station will ensure Art on the Air may continue bringing you the best of the arts and culture programming for Northwest Indiana and beyond. If Art on the Air is important to you, please consider supporting this station with a one-time contribution or even making an ongoing sustaining contribution. For information on how to make a contribution, go to this station's website or our show website, breck.com/AOTA. And thank you.
This is Hannah Hammond Hagman of Chesterton Art Center, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Umala June to Art on the Air. Umala is a pastel artist focusing on the balance and interplay between human form and surreal landscapes. She strives to create landscapes as if they were living entities with emotions and meaning. She is also very involved with Lang Lab in South Bend, Indiana, a multi-use co-work space focusing on the arts. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Umala. Very, very nice seeing you.
Hey, it's nice seeing you guys too.
Well, it's great to see you. And how we like to start our interviews out with is basically this first question is your origin story. I like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Umala.
All right. So it actually started off when I was living in La Porte. I was a sort of like, you know, I was a country girl. I grew up on a farm. And, you know, I sort of had this sense of like, always being outside, and I was always outside. I've always been kind of the one that wanted to look at every little shape that that nature kind of creates. And then my dad, he was always somebody that taught me a lot about nature. So I know all the trees, I know all the different plants and animals and everything. And he made sure that I knew that the land around me was in fact alive. It's not just this dead thing that we could create, like a tree. He was always like, don't rip the bark off of the tree. Is that hurts the tree. It's a living thing. It damages it. So I've always had that sort of respect when I'm growing up. However, that kind of felt like I wasn't in a community of artists, growing up. And, you know, I'd go in like the little theater, like the, you know, community theater, but that was more for performance-based artists rather than visual artists. So I think it was when I finally moved to South Bend, it's when I actually was like, oh, there's community in art. There's a sense of like understanding people and artwork. So I was able to like bounce off different ideas. However, I still kind of focused in on either art as landscape as a way of escapism, or landscape as sort of like a sense of understanding yourself. For example, some of my figurative work with a lot of like mountainist and like all the mountains and the sea and everything, that I kind of think of as more of me escaping from how dreary the Midwest can be. But then I've created a series called Fishcorn Series, where the fishcorn is a self-portrait of myself, but it is exploring the beauties of the Midwest. So I kind of have these two ideas that kind of almost work against each other. But in reality, I think like it's one is explaining how much I want to escape from where I'm at. But one is kind of showing this acceptance of where I'm at.
So you described this childhood outside, but how did elementary, middle, and high school support you? Did you know you were interested in art in those? Were there wonderful art programs? Is your father artistic? You know,
my grandma was really artistic. So she kind of drew a couple things for me here and there. My middle school art teacher, I think, was like very supportive. So I was always that artsy kid, you know. But I think, I wasn't like...
So was it in drawing?
Yeah, I was always drawing, either colored pencils, but then I found pastels. Just when I was at United Art and Education randomly one day, I was like kind of picking up and I was like, ooh, I like this. And then I never dropped them, so...
Yeah, the depth and saturation of those colors are... And how they blend. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. And it's sort of like the fragility of it too. It's like, it's not, I don't know. Sometimes I wish I was an oil painter just because then it would dry and I never have to worry about it.
I know if it drops, it's not all going to like
never
powder down.
Will always be as fragile, fragile as a butterfly's wing. So
yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Tell us what some of you kind of touched on a few of your subjects for inspiration, but tell us about some of the subjects that inspire you in your pastel work.
I started off drawing a lot of nudity, just sort of like understanding how fragile the human body is and sort of having it be the same, sort of like treating it the same way as a landscape. So I would always incorporate the body with the landscapes. And then I kind of thought of it as like a mental sort of sense, like they are not really like you're kind of just seeing what somebody is experiencing internally. So I'm kind of using that as it's like an internal landscape rather than an external. But then I'm kind of working on a different series, which is the Fishcorn series, which I kind of want to think of it as a self-reflection, like it's more of a reflection on myself rather than others. Also, I got tired of asking people to get naked for me. You know, that's a hard ask.
Well, so I have a quick question about a series. When you're talking about a series, how many paintings are you thinking about?
Thinking about quite a bit, but I have at least five. Like this one, there's one on my shirt. I have at least five fish corns that I've finished, but then tomorrow I'm planning on starting another one, which kind of focuses on just sort of depression, I suppose. I want to kind of like just get really dark with this one. Some of the fish corns have more of a deeper meaning than others. But it's always a rainbow trout within a corn. The rainbow trout is really interesting just simply because they don't, like, you have hatcheries that sort of release them and then all of a sudden
it's right.
And that's always great. And then, but I never catch a trout on trout season, and that just ticks me off in some way. But the trout also is nice, good for the environment because eagles eat them, and then that they're the protein inside of a rainbow trout kind of hardens their eggs. So there's a little symbolic sort of meaning,
yeah,
within the rainbow trout. But together, I don't know, but then like inside the corn, I think of it as comfort. So I created this character, but fish corn is going through a journey, and it's my journey, but it's going through a journey in the Midwest, but I still want to kind of create the Midwest in this very surreal manner.
It sounds like a book, Umala.
I'm trying. Yeah, you're good. It's been a journey of just me like kind of creating the self-reflection through.
So I'm wondering, like, when you're facing a blank canvas, what's your first step? I mean, before you step to the canvas, do you have an idea or?
Yeah, actually, I usually have extensive amount of notes before I go on the paper, you know?
You do multiple sketches ahead of time before
I do multiple sketches, and usually they're like quick and illiterate, like, you know, like, like people look at my sketches and they're like, that doesn't look anything like anything, but it's like I understand the composition and the meaning, so it's kind of just like a quick, like 5 second, like, ooh, and then like I'll write about it. And then if I really like am married to the idea, like if I'm going to spend 7 months on like say something this big, I want to draw it out with graphite a little bit deeper. Still kind of ask myself, I'm like, do you want to spend 7 months on this idea? You kind of have to treat every idea like a relationship, you know, you're going to spend time with this person, this idea. So it's worth.
Changed much from the first till the end, or are you just refining it during that 7 months, let's say?
Sometimes, well, there's also the chance that I'm working on multiple pieces at once.
Sure, of course. Yeah, I was wondering if when you know, like when you say it takes 7 months, is it you're changing your mind or that you're refining?
It's just so detail oriented. like my pastels are not like these big paintbrushes. Like they're like these tiny little things that I have to like pinch, you know, like. And really hold on to. So it's just detail oriented. So
capturing your ideas, do you sometimes photograph maybe a scene and or scenes, and then maybe even take elements from those photographs to kind of combine it, or what? Yeah. Give us a little bit of your process.
So I have family in Montana, so I'll take a lot of photos, like say, like if I want a mountain scene, I'll take a lot of mountain photos in Montana for references. My references are never the Bible. I will change them because I'm like, well, I'm not transferring a photo like to an image. I could do that in Photoshop, you know. So usually I take a bunch of photos and just sort of get the overall feeling, create my own sort of mountain range, my own piece, so it's not like oh, this is the arches from blah, 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 or this is the mountain from blah, blah, blah. And then I would incorporate that into a piece, but I always like kind of add multiple elements together. So it's not like just.
Yeah. Could you describe your paintings at all? Maybe even the one, I don't know if you want to describe the one behind you, but maybe a completed piece, like what?
I have a nude landscape as well as a fish corn here. So I could explain both of them if you want.
Great.
So this one, I kind of wanted to like kind of have this one as like a sort of a form of chance. You have a male nude figure in the corner as well as a female nude corner, and it's kind of, they're making this circular look. So male and woman, but they're kind of like looking off to the distance. I kind of wanted to explore the feeling of just being lonely with somebody, that you're lonely together in a way. But I feel like the piece has different meaning when you flip it. So if I were to enter this into a show or give this to a gallery, I'm going to have two wires. So, and then I'll just say top on both sides. So whoever hangs it, it's their choice whether they could put it up or right. Or, you know, if you want the female to be grounded or the male to be grounded. Also their gestures, they have different gestures, the meaning like, when I had the model for the male sit down, he was actually kind of saying how he, as a male, feels like he can't express, be open with other people as much. He's a little more, held together. He doesn't give out emotionally because that's what women do. So I kind of took that to heart and I had him hold his hand into his chest. Reserved while the woman has her arm out.
It's kind of interesting because from where I am seeing, because we're, you know, where I am, it sort of reminded me of the Sistine Chapel almost. It has sort of that feel to it.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, it's definitely, it's getting together. I think there's like a few things that I need to change here and there, so it's not completely finished.
After a brief pause, we will return to our Art on the Air guest. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners. Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So outside of pastels, is there another, you know, I mean, you touched on that about oils, and you were just kind of making that sort of as a side remark, but is there something other art that you would like to pursue that you haven't explored outside of pastels?
I have done quite a bit of, I mean, I've painted in oil. It's not something I absolutely love as much as pastels.
Yeah, pastels are more immediate.
Yeah, if I like, oh, I'm sorry, that was, if somebody was to say, okay, hands down, you have to change your medium, I would say, yeah, maybe painting, but also probably printmaking. But I just really can't see myself like getting out of the pastel realm yet.
I thought you were going to say ceramics.
No. Ceramics would be interesting, but yeah. Pick up a banjo. Yes, banjo.
Yeah, there you go. So what do you do for fun outside of art? I mean, is there some, what do you pursue that you like? Okay, I know it might be even nature related from your background, but you know, tell us what you do for fun.
Hiking, crocheting. I guess crocheting is an art. I see that more of a hobby. Do crochet some clothes here and there. Practicing the banjo. So
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Hang out with my dog. But mostly hiking. So. But I also grew up around horses, so I do like the horseback ride here and there.
Do you miss that, being where you are in South Bend?
Yes. It was really such a tear between like living somewhere close with a community versus living somewhere where there's trees, you know? I'm like, I don't know how to split my self because
your psyche.
Such a community driven person is what sucks. And my community's not, it's not where the horses are, sadly.
So is the banjo a completely private thing, or do you play it with other people?
Oh, I'm terrible at the banjo. I'm going to tell you that right now. I just like it.
Well, what drew you to the banjo, though? I mean, that's kind of a, it's kind of a curious instrument to pick up.
Yeah. I just like it. I like it too
a lot.
I play when I know nobody's listening. So
but isn't the Lang Lab? Why don't you talk to us about the Lang Lab and what is, because that's like such, I mean, if there were other banjo players, they would be there.
Oh, yeah, they are. I could actually hear a person on the other side now that's a hell of a banjo player. But
describe the atmosphere and what goes on at the Lang Lab. The
Lab is basically where all of us artsy misfits get together and we have a place. This is our place. If you're an artist out there listening, this is your place. It's we have figure drawing. That's something I run. Critique night.
You just do something together. Come, we're out.
Which is what critique night, which is what I run. And then you have we have spray painting classes, so like graffiti classes. We have music days where like Tuesdays, a bunch of musicians are downstairs doing open mic. There's a bar. There's places to work on your crafts. There's studios upstairs and downstairs, so it's a pretty nice spot. And there's always something for everyone here.
There's dance, right? There's music.
There's
dance. What kind of opportunities are there? Because I know there's always a list of happenings going on, like performances. Theater?
There's a venue. Sometimes they have opera singers like practicing, but it's like a little bit of everything, you know? The thing is, like, if you wanted something to happen, you can make it happen here. Like, for example, I wanted a group of artists to discuss their philosophies of art. So I went to the owner. I was like, "Hey, I want this to happen." And she was like, "Yeah, go for it. You have a space." And I created Critique Night. And all I really had to do was just ask for permission, and you can make it happen. So if you ever want to organize something, this is the place for
that. It's a good place to do it. So I have a question. So you sort of intimated that this piece has taken about 7 months. Do you have an idea where you're going to show it when you're making a piece?
I have a show coming up at Bunbury Gallery. Mm-hmm. That's over by the Morris. It's a new art gallery ran by Guy Hall. But I will have a show coming up in March. And I'm also in the Pastel Society. So I'll have shows there.
Is it a solo show or is it a group show?
It'll be a solo show.
Yay, I do have
pieces already there at the moment. However, somebody else is having a solo show, so my stuff are not on the walls currently, but I am in his collection. So
that's wonderful.
Anything else further into 2026 that you have and beyond March?
At the moment, no. That's kind of the main show I'm focusing on. It will take a couple of months, but then I will be searching.
So do you have an idea of where Fishcorn will be shown?
Fishcorn will be at Bunbury Gallery.
Oh, it's same. Okay.
Yeah, so I'll try to make a whole wall for Bunbury Gallery. So.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
And we kind of touched on it, but any other projects further in the year? I mean, in terms of work, your stuff, things you have ideas that you haven't actually rendered yet?
Oh, so many. So many. I'm actually kind of developing a language for abstraction. So I'm trying to focus more. I'm getting away from the surrealist landscape, and I'm trying to make more of an abstract landscape. And trying to really focus on how I can make a landscape look more abstract and kind of focusing.
Yeah, abstraction is not easy.
Oh, it's not. It's actually really difficult because I'm my brain of how to work with something like, oh, this is how I see it, this is how I feel it, but I really need to focus on how I feel it. So I'm trying to switch to more abstract pieces rather than the hyper realistic that people are used to seeing. So
well, we have just about a minute left here. I want to give you an opportunity to tell how people can find out about your work, like online, contact information, such as that.
Yeah. So my Instagram is pastel_dust_. So it's pastel dust, but pastel_dust_. And then you'll see a black and white photo of me with my name that says Umala. So, it is pastel_dust_.
Excellent. We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your art journey. I know there's so much more that we could talk about, but we appreciate telling you about Pastel and your thing. Umala June, and it's her on Art in the Air, and we appreciate you coming on the show, sharing you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.